at session number 28626, reel 14.
And there were, again, it goes back to the intelligence gatherers, the INT 14 INT company, working through their civilian sleepers, moles, whatever they call them, and the other intelligence gathering organisations. It could be static cameras, it could be OPs, it could be the SAS, it could be police special forces informers, all manner of things, which was put into brigade or the headquarters of Lisbon, the main headquarters, and that would then feed its way back in a nightly intrep.
Okay. And was that the intelligence, like, that was coming back from the soldiers out in the streets and that, was that on radio that was getting sent back?
Yeah, but most of the time it was. If they felt that the information was, it wasn't time sensitive, they would bring it back in note form in their books. But if they felt it was important and it had to be relayed then and there and then, they would encode it and send it back.
Okay. And you mentioned this place called Fort White Rock, was that?
Fort White Rock.
And was it an old army building or
no,
something?
No, it was built by the engineers. It's a Wrigley tin, prefabricated base. Concrete, huge concrete pillars put together, interlocking, overlapping, building an enormous perimeter wall. This camp would have been the size of 1.5 football pitches. It had a running, it had this huge corrugated wall built all around it. It was scaffolding. The tin was then put on the outside so you couldn't see in. It had concrete pillars here and there to, again, provide that additional support so things couldn't be blown in or whatever. They also built shelters so if it was being mortared and the mortars were actually getting into the fort, you could go into one of these concrete shelters. And then inside that, it had a whole series of porter cabins, on the roof of which, raised above the roof by about 18 inches, was a series of mesh. So a mortar round coming in, if it happened to land on top of a building, it blew up the mesh and not the roof of the porter cabin, therefore protecting what was inside there. So that's how the camp was set up. There was a running track created about the width of a person, around the outside, around the inside, if I can say that, of the corrugated wall. But it was the outside of the camp for us. And we used to run around there. The other thing we had in there, of course, we had search dogs and guard dogs were also housed in Fort White Rock with boys from the Army Veterans Corps and the Orange Police. And we used them. They did their fair share of work.
Okay. And what about your accommodation? Was that in the porter cabins?
Yeah, we had the officers had the officers' accommodation, senior NCOs theirs, and the junior NCOs and the jocks had their platoon accommodation. So you live with your muckers, the guys you went out in the street with. So the four of you in the brick would live in your own bed, and vice versa. So you lived and breathed with the guys that you did your daily job with, in the same way that I did in Wrecking Platoon. You know, you live with the same guys, and that's how you get to know their problems, if they're depressed, or if somebody's particularly good at something. You know, you pick this sort of stuff up. So that's how you worked. We had an officer's mess, little officer's mess, with its own cookhouse. The senior NCOs had one, and then there was a big cookhouse for the lads. And it was a cosy, quite a big camp, but it was cosy. Once you got everybody in there, it was quite tight. When all the vehicles came in and everything else, it was quite tight.
And was it ever attacked during the time that you were there? Was there ever a tent?
Yeah, there was somebody drove a, I recall, drove a, what they said was an improvised explosive device in the form of a car towards the main gate, and the precautions were taken. The EOD boys arrived and it was diffused. I'm not sure, to be honest, it was a real EOD. We were mortared, but no mortars landed in the camp in my time there. I believe when Neil Smith was doing the ops officer's job, there was AIM water did arrive or land in the eastern end of the camp without causing any damage. Just some shrapnel on the concrete, because there's a big, that was the one area which is quite open, fortunately.
And you mentioned, you know, the running track that you had as well. Was it quite difficult for you to keep up your physical fitness there? You know, was it... But, well, could you go out and maybe have a run in the street?
No, you were out. You were out. The lads were out for at least 8 hours a day on the street. At least 8 hours a day. Those who were doing the Sanger duties within the fort were working on a 24-hour, 48-hour, 64-hour cycle. So they were sort of 2 hours on, 4 hours off, 2 hours on, 4 hours off, or whatever was required to fit the number of Sangers and the main gate and do all that. There was a gymnasium there, or I said not a gymnasium, it was a hangar at the one end of the camp where we had a multi-gym type thing. And you could do running and play football and play some squash. Very good at producing squash courts, these army bases. They always have a couple of squash courts. And a sort of area you can play volleyball or badminton, that sort of thing. And that would be used, again, to set up a little multi-gym, little weights room, and the boys would do that. But on the whole, they kept themselves pretty fit. And believe me, going around the streets for 8 or 12 or 16 hours a day, you get pretty used to it and you get quite fit.
And what about relaxation? You've mentioned the different messes. Was there ever occasions when you might be able to go out for a pint or something, or to the cinema? You know,
we did bring the cinema into the camp, but the services, Sound and Vision Corporation, SSVC, would bring in the mobile cinema. So you get somebody coming in the back of a pig armoured car with the reel-to-reel set up in one of the places, like the cookhouse, and the lads would watch that film or a couple of films. Going out, because we were on a 6 month enrolment business, we didn't have a permanent base. Our permanent base was Fort White Rock, and the other companies had their own little permanent bases like Girdwood Park and I forget the other two, but there wasn't actually a place that we could go. If we asked the regular battalion, who were in Palace Barracks or Hollywood, then yes, we could an admin run there with a number of blokes to do something in their camp, which is a permanent camp. But that didn't happen very often. We were busy enough, and you know, the army did their best to look after you, and you just got on with the job.
And this camp that you're speaking about as well, Fort White Rock, is it still there, do you think? Or?
Oh, no. It would have gone. Like all the Sangers on the border, these temporary structures would have been removed. Those buildings, those camps that were already in built-up areas and were, you know, proper buildings, they'll still be there, but they'll have a completely different use. And anything that looked military, any towers or gates made out of corrugated iron or anything like that would have been removed. So that you'll see very little of that evidence.
Okay. And you mentioned the building work that was going on there. I was quite surprised by that. I thought that maybe during the years of the Troubles that there hadn't been a lot of building, you know, that...
No, well, certainly. We were in a Catholic area. We were working in a Catholic area. Like all cities, they don't stand still, they just get bigger and bigger. And southwest Belfast was getting bigger and bigger. And literally, in 2 months of us arriving there, one new estate of the southwestern end of the city appeared. And it went from being six houses to 106 houses. You know, and that's quite a fair chunk of land, because these weren't small houses. They were you know, good size, two or three bedroom houses. So there was certainly plenty going on.
How did you manage to communicate with your wife at that point? You know, was she still in Germany, or did she come back to Britain? Or?
No, she at that point she was still in Germany. Yeah, she was still in Germany. Phone her up now again.
So you could phone easily enough?
Oh yeah, we had phones, yeah. You had, there was always a bank of sort of six phones, but I have to be honest, we're not great at phoning each other. We do it once a week. I'm not into phoning every day. Once a week. That'd be it.
Okay, so when it was coming to the end of your 6 months there, did you know where you were going after that?
Yeah, I was going back to I basically finished with the battalion, and I was away to Warminster, where I was going to attend the junior division of the Staff College, JDSC, which is an opportunity for young officers, captains nearly always, to learn more about staff writing, service writing, and all the processes that go with that, and just as importantly, tactics. But at a middle manager's level. It's fine, I've done PCBC and I've learned about it from a platoon commander's level. Now we're stepping up and we're looking at it from captain's to major's level. And what happens here is that the staff at JDSC are trying to identify those officers who will make good adjutants and ops officers, those who perhaps will go away on staff jobs, and I ultimately went away on a staff job. And it's also preparing them for the what they call PQS2, which is the sort of progressive staff qualification exam that you need to take for promotion to major. But also, if you did well enough in it, that gave you the inroads to the Staff College at Camberley, which is really what you had to want to aspire to, because that gave you the opportunity to go on above major and hopefully get half colonel, or you know, the many lads who've gone all the way up to lieutenant general or general. So it's a very important time for me, because I wasn't a brilliant academic. But the time spent at JDSC under my two instructors went well for me. I had a Scots Guards instructor for my staff writing, and I'd always struggle with that, but I actually did quite well, because it's a precise art, you know. And if you learn something that's a precise art, you'll always do it. And I learnt it. Yes, I made a few mistakes, but I learnt it well enough to be one of the better guys on the course at it. And then when we came to the tactics phase, where I was working with Neil McGregor Smith, who was an Argyle, who I knew, I really did enjoy that. I found that very straightforward. And I was lucky. And it all comes back to the fact that I spent time as a platoon commander of a demonstration battalion for 2 years at Warminster, with all the variety of things we were doing. And then my time as company second in command in Belize, and then recce platoon. The sniper course that I'd done, the 4-day controllers course I'd done, all these things really helped me on JDSC. And I was one of the top students on the tactics, which was great, because I was never going to pass the staff exam, but I passed JDSC with a very good recommendation, which was fantastic for me.
And how long did the course actually last for?
Top of my head, Arlene, I would have said it was a 6 month course. I could be wrong, it could have been 4 months, but it was a long time. And my second son was born there at Trowbridge, and they wouldn't let me off for 2 hours to go and attend his birth. Yet other guys were taking 3 days off ill, and nothing was said, and they weren't even ill. You know, it just staggered me when you've got a legitimate reason. They wouldn't do it. Totally different now, of course. Totally different now. The army has advanced in the 21st century, but then, back in the mid 80s, oh no. No, family came third on the list.
So your family came back to Britain while you were there?
Yeah, uh-huh. They came back. We moved them back, and we got a house at Elm Hill at Warminster, which was to be our home for the next 2.5 years. Because once I finished JDSC, I was posted immediately to the next door office to platoon commander's battle course.
Okay, and the house you had, was that an army one?
Yeah, very much an army house, single brick, freezing, metal window frames, absolutely freezing. Big garden, because we were a corner house, but we had an absolutely superb 2.5 years here, because the guys that I worked with on PCBC my fellow instructors were just top-notch blokes.
And, you know, how did you get there? Did you put your name in for it, or were you selected for it?
For PCBC, when you go there after you finish Santos, or in our time when you were sent there, the rule is now that when you finish Santos, you go straight to PCBC. But I had a gap of, I went straight from Santos to PCBC because I was going to Ireland. And therefore, I had to do that. But some guys came back and had been out of the... I'd been away from Santos for 4 years, which must have been very hard for them, because there's nothing better than getting it done straight after Santos. With all due respect to the fact that you've already spent a year at Santos, do the extra 4 or 5 months and get it out of the way, because it does give you the grounding and tactics that you need. And I was lucky. I got a recommendation when I was there to return as an instructor from the then Captain Alistair Irwin, who later finished the army as Lieutenant General Sir Alistair Irwin, who was Black Watch. So he recommended that I, in the fullness of time, would be an appropriate person to go back to instruct. And so when I was asked by the commanding officer, would I consider going to PCBC, I said, definitely, yes, I'm the man.
Okay, and did you not mind being away from the Gordons at that point? Were you still...
No, the truth was that because I, as a subaltern, I'd done effectively just over a year with the battalion, and then was posted to demonstration battalion for 2 and a bit years, I'd spent more time almost away than I had there. Yes, I came back to do company commander and then recce, but in between time I was away for 6 months at Santos again. So I'd actually spent quite a lot of time away, a good balance, I have to say. I also realised that with the best will in the world, Maurice Gibson was not destined to be too high in the Gordons, because my face didn't necessarily fit the Gordon Hounder's prescribed image. So I was quite happy to work outside that and earn my spurs in the bigger army. And I did okay.
Why do you feel that your face didn't fit?
Well, in the old-fashioned traditional regimental system, there were those who were in and there were those who were out. I was out. I wasn't socially as competent as others. I wasn't a great dancer. I was more an operations and training man. I like getting dirty. The Gordons liked a bit of that, but they also wanted those who were more socially acceptable. And that's just a fact of life. And that's the way other regiments were as well. But my face didn't quite fit, so I was quite happy to serve my time elsewhere.
Okay. So you did your course there, and then did you automatically go into the instructors?
Yeah. I mean, as soon as I finished one day, the next day I started as an instructor. I'm sure it was a light infantry officer, but I can't remember his name. Anyhow, so I went in as the Scots Div officer there, and my responsibilities, firstly, all the instructors looked after a syndicate of 10 officers. My responsibilities, key responsibilities, were mechanised warfare, so learning about how to fight the 432 armoured personnel carrier with all its attachments, and secondly was the nuclear, biological and chemical warfare. So I looked after those two core subjects. It was my responsibility to be the best at it and know it about it. I also obviously then had to help the other instructors with all their exercises, and vice versa, they helped me. In their directing staff capacity, I had to be able to teach all the subjects as they did. They were on offer, well, not on offer, but they were part of the syllabus. But anything to do with mechanised warfare and MVC, I had to write the notes on and make sure that all the DS had them, so they were up to date, and the DS would then brief off those notes and teach their syndicates off those notes. I would do central presentations on these things, using all the gadgetry that the various halls had at Warminster, and it was a pretty advanced place. Warminster had some very good stuff. After 6 months of doing that, I was asked to step up, continue to lead on mechanized warfare and MVC, but they wanted me to become the directing staff coordinator. I wasn't the senior DS, but they felt that I had the ability to get the other staff, the other captains, the major, and the colour sergeants who were part of this team, a very good team, very close-knit team. I had the ability to get them to work together, and if one wasn't doing something, I was in a position to say, hey, put your socks up, because I know you're not doing it. Whereas some of the other lads weren't quite as good as that, but they were excellent instructors, but they weren't quite as good at coordinating everything. The DS coordinator had to go to all the range conferences and do all the bookings, had to write the program for the whole package every time, and we ran three courses a year, plus two TA courses, so five courses a year. I had to do all the staff work to get that up to speed, and this was partly because I'd done a decent job on JDSC. They said that I can do it. I knew the personalities at Warminster because I'd been there, so I was in a strong position to do it. It was a bit daunting because I did enjoy the instructing a bit. I did enjoy having my own syndicate, but once I'd done it for 5 months, I was very happy. I wrote a pamphlet along with the sort of the second in command of PCBC, the major. So there was a pamphlet with him, which is still in use today. It's been upgraded, of course, but it still forms the basis of it. Infantry training pamphlet, volume 1 and 2, there's all the bits and pieces in it. And that was good. So it was a very interesting time. Great people to work with. We had Mark Hutchings from the Gurkhas, Chris Whiteley from the Marines, Mark Kelly from the Australian Army, and he's now a general, one of the senior Australian generals. We had Billy McLean from the Coldstream Guards, Chip Chapman from the Paras, who was a young lad, very young lad, who went straight from Santa State to the Falklands War. And he was a brigadier, maybe a general now, but there's some really good people. The colour sergeants were just as good, from the Parachute Regiment, from the Royal Regiment of Fusiliers, from the Duke of Edinburgh's Royal Regiment, from the Royal Scots, a really good team, and from the RAF Regiment. We had an RAF Regiment flight sergeant. So it was such a pleasure to work with these guys because they were all very experienced, they were all good fun, they worked hard, they play hard. One of the best things we did was we were all quite keen rugby players and quite good rugby players. So we all joined the School of Infantry rugby team, and we didn't, I say transform it, but we took it to a completely new level, from being just another army rugby team to being one of the best army rugby teams in the country. And we took on some of the biggest teams and we gave them a real scare and we beat some of them. But that was going to be short-lived because obviously we were all instructors and we were going to be posted at some point. So, but nonetheless, it gave us a huge amount of pride and it gave other units a huge amount of sort of, oh my gosh, we could have done our homework probably. But it was a great tour. Thoroughly, just really enjoyed it. Jane loved it because the wives of the guys, most of them were married. We all got on. In fact, we used to go on a Five Nations rugby thing like we have now with the Six Nations. On the weekend, we'd all go to each other's houses. So they'd all come to my house, we'd all drink beer, we'd all have stogies for lunch, and we'd watch the game. And of course, we had Welshmen, Englishmen, Scotsmen, and Irishmen. So there was a huge amount of competition between not just the players on the park watching the telly, but between us doing this and that. So it was really good fun. These things don't come around that often. So it was the sort of tour that you just dream about.
So it sounds like it was a good social...
Oh, fantastic, fantastic, yeah.
Okay, and was it like normal working hours you were working during that period?
No, not really. When you're working at a staff establishment, you're working long hours. These training establishments, the young officers will be on the go from 8 in the morning, they are unlikely to finish and be back in the mess before 6 at night. They'll then have work to do in the evenings, and you need to be around to provide assistance if they're struggling with something, or some of you do, not all of you, because you didn't all go and sit there waiting. You know, but two would be on duty, a colour sergeant and an officer would be on duty. And then, of course, we were on exercise a lot. So when you went away, you went out on a Monday morning, and you'd come back Friday afternoon. So you'd be away on exercise, either on Salisbury Plain. We quite often went to Brecon in Wales and exercised there. And occasionally we went to other places, other training areas for specific things. So there was a lot of time out of barracks. From my point of view, as DS Ward, I spent a lot of time, obviously, in barracks, but every exercise I was on. But I didn't have to do the nighttime duty thing, because I was probably sitting in the office until 8 o'clock doing paperwork anyhow.
It sounds as though it was quite hard for the wives. You know, the men must have been working quite a lot in different hours, long hours, and it must have been quite difficult for them at times.
Yeah, I think that's probably very fair. But their wives all got on very well, so they all supported each other. It's an incredible environment. It really was. We're all part of the school infantry, but PCBC, the young captains we had there, were all full of fun, and the colour sergeants and the sergeant major, all full of fun. And when we had a mess night or a ball, it was brilliant. Life and soul of the party.
Okay. And was there any gain for you being this course instead of maybe being with the Gordons? Were you paid more or anything?
It's a job I would suggest that any aspiring young captain would want to do.
Okay. And the subjects you were teaching as well, nuclear as well, was that a real threat at that time? Was it believed that that would be the next war?
Yeah, definitely. It's always been in the equation that the Russians, the Soviet bloc, would use nuclear, because they had a nuclear capability. So did we, so did the Americans, so did the French. They certainly had biological agents. They used them in various parts of Russia and on the periphery. And chemical weapons came to the fore in the First World War. And once you've done that, things don't go backwards. So the Russians had big stocks of artillery shells, particularly, with chemical substances over top. So it was a threat. They could use these things on a tactical basis or on a much bigger area, putting down some fairly hefty missiles and stuff. So it was a real threat. The lads had to know how to operate in the protective equipment issued to them, so the respirator, the smock, which is a carbon-lined smock with a hood, trousers, carbon-lined trousers, and rubber overboots and rubber gloves. Very degrading to work in this environment. Very hot, very sweaty, not pleasant. But they had to know how to put this stuff on very quickly. How to decontaminate themselves properly, and how to live in this stuff and fight in it.
And I know now that we know a lot more about the Soviet Union, Russia at the time, but were you getting much information coming through at the time about what they had, or was it still quite a guessing game? Or
No, I mean, to be fair, we were as up to date as anybody on what they were reported to hold in stock. Your sarins, nerve agents, blister agents, the various biological agents like anthrax and nuclear. Well, we all knew they had nuclear because they'd been testing it, and that's why we had the whole standoff and the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's all to do with the nuclear capability. So we had a pretty good idea of what they held. They may have had other things that we weren't aware of that they'd developed. And that's probably still the issue today.
And, at Warminster as well, was it only the British Army there, or you know, were any of the Commonwealth armies or what had been the Commonwealth armies?
There were, the British Army was the only army there, but there were overseas officers and senior NCOs serving there in some capacity.